there wasn't. When did you leave it here?
Last hour.
Really? It could be that the previous lecturer might have taken it. She wasn't here when I arrived.
Thank you.
Sorry. Okay, so let's make a start. It's going to be more probabilities today and an introduction to Bayes' rule and why Bayes' rule is so useful for doing probabilistic inference, for estimating the things about the state, properties about the state that you're interested in when you don't have direct access to that thing's probability distribution. Bayes' rule comes to the rescue, and that's what I'm going to try and get across today. Okay, so what we've done so far is we've talked a little bit about what the sort of representation of rational agents as doing a deliberation on how to act, deciding how to act on the basis of trying to find an optimal trade-off between the degree to which they want something on the one hand and the likelihood that they can make that thing true on the other. And they try and maximize that that product of the probability of that state and the extent to which they want it. And they aim for whichever state maximizes that product. Maybe they do. We saw that humans don't always, may aspire to it, but don't always achieve it. And so what we're doing in this portion of the course is focusing on this, on the probabilities, and in the last week of the course, we're going to then factor in utilities as well. So the whole course ends with you being able to learn and understand, hopefully, Markov decision processes, as they're called. But we're starting with the basics. So I introduced last time the notion of random variables and the notion of probability distributions over them, and some basic axioms of probabilities, like probabilities are all between 0 and 1. Sum of the probabilities of every value for a given random variable sums to 1, and so on. And what we haven't done yet is talk about inference with probabilities. So that's what we're going to do today. Okay. So the problem then that we want to address now is, we've got some evidence. We're interested in whether a state has a given property, but we can't directly observe that property. But we do have evidence that we can observe, which gives us a clue as to that property, what's known as the query proposition. How do we, in the light of the evidence we've got, compute the posterior probability, posterior in the sense of I'm going to take that evidence into account now that I've got it, of that proposition, of that query, okay? That's the problem, and in any probabilistic inference task. And what we're going to do today is look at a simple method that is basically table lookup on a joint probability distribution, talk about why that's not practical in many cases, and so do a form of exact inference in this, but where we don't need this complete table. And that exploits Bayes' rule. And anyone doing probabilistic inference is exploiting Bayes' rule left, right, and center. Okay? So here is an example of a joint probability distribution involving that same example I was talking about last time about toothache and two possible causes for toothache, the cavity and the catch, or even both of them may be causing toothache. So there are eight possible states, given that we have three random variables and they're all Boolean, right? So that's 2 cubed, which is 8 possible states. And each one of these cells is specifying the probability that you're in one of those exclusive states. Call these atomic, in probability terms, you can also call them atomic events. So for example, this little cell here up in the left-hand corner is the probability that you've got a cavity and a catch and toothache, okay? And the probability of that is 0.108. Or the one here is the probability that you have no toothache, no catch, and no cavity. Pretty likely, actually, over 50%. And the probability of this guy is the probability that you've got a cavity, no catch, and no toothache. A pretty low probability of 0.08, okay? So this is the way to read this table. Notice that they all sum to one, which is as you'd expect given the axioms of probability theory that I gave you last week on Friday, okay? Now, from this, you can compute the probability of any Boolean formula involving these variables, right? So for example, the probability that you have a catch or a cavity, how do you get that? Well, you sum the probabilities, you sum the out of the eight probabilities that you've got here, you sum those where either cavity or catch or both are true. So that's, this one has both of them true. This one has cavity true, as does this, and as does this. So you sum all of them. In fact, the only one you don't use, I believe, is this one and this one, okay? These two guys. Because neither the catch nor the cavity are true. They only vary as to whether the toothache is true or not, okay? So that's the sum of six probabilities out of the eight in this table, and it comes to about a third, okay? Any questions? Okay. Don't forget, with this is not exclusive OR, so you include this guy where they're both true, and this guy where they're both true, okay? All right, so given the axioms of probability, what are we playing with there? Well, actually, what I did here is what's known as marginalization. I summed over I basically abstracted over the value of toothache. I don't care what the value of toothache is. I only care what the value of catch and of cavity is. So I summed over all the cases where toothache is true, which are these guys. Is it these guys? These guys, these three guys, toothache is true. These three guys, toothache is false, okay? So I marginalized out the value of toothache in my estimation of this guy. That's what's going on here. Except here it's in a more general way because I'm actually interested in the value of two variables as opposed to one. In fact, no, this is a vector. So this is the more general thing. When I have these Y's in bold, I'm talking vectors of random variables, okay? So an arbitrary number of them. So you can marginalize out when what you've got is the joint, only that you don't have access directly to the probability distribution for just this vector. What you do have is access to the probability distribution of this vector joined with other values you're not interested in. You can sum them out, right? Probability theory allows you to do that because that sum, because of the way probabilities work and the sum of all the possible values on a given random variable sums to one, okay? So likewise, here's another example where I'm just interested in the probability of cavity. So I don't care about toothache, I don't care about catch. That means that I'm going to sum out all the possible, sum over all the probabilities where cavity is true, but toothache and catch have any value, right? I sum all of those from the joint probability table. So it's just a lookup situation we have here, where you're looking up particular cells in your table, summing them, and getting an answer. And in fact, the answer is 0.2, okay? So if you have this wonderful thing called a joint probability distribution table, with every cell filled, you can basically work out the probability for any proposition of those variables in any Boolean combination of those variables, involved in the joint probability distribution, and any subset of them. Conditioning is another variant where, should you, instead of having direct access to the joint probability distribution, instead you've got direct access to the conditional probability distribution, again, because of the axioms of probability, you can still sum out the variables you're not interested in, so long as you also have the probabilities for the individual prior probabilities for those variables too, direct access to those. So sometimes using this equation is useful, because you don't have access to this guy, but you have access to this probability distribution and this one too, then you can, you know, infer the probability distribution of this guy on the left from that. So you see the trick. With probabilistic inference, what you're always doing is thinking about what probability distributions you do have access to, that you can observe directly from your data, and using things like these equations, the axioms of probability, to estimate the probability of the thing that actually you're interested in but don't have direct access to. So here's an example where we're computing a conditional probability from a combination of joint probability and a prior probability. Now, I showed you how to get the estimate the probability of toothache, well, probability of cavity, but it's the same for toothache, using marginalization. So that's what these four numbers are from the joint probability table, right? They're these four guys where toothache is true, okay? And the joint probability you do in the same of cavity and toothache, you do in the same way with marginalization. You just sum over all the cases where cavity and toothache are true and catches any value. So that's this guy and this guy. And you get your answer, 0.6 for the conditional probability, okay? So when you've got the joint probability table, basically, in a way, you're done. You know, you can work out anything from that, because the axioms of probability theory allow you to. Now, with normalization, it gives you a little shortcut for finding the probability distribution, or conditional probability distribution. Notice here, cavity is a capital letter, and the P is a bold P. So that's saying, I want the probability distribution. I don't just want the probability of the positive guy, I want the probability of the negative guy. Or if this was not a Boolean variable, but say it was a continuous variable, taking finite values, I want all those values, right? Well, you can do that via the joint probability when you add a normalization factor on it. Why does that work? Well, because the probability of toothache is fixed. I have fixed the value of toothache to be positive. So this is just going to be the same number whatever value cavity is taking in the probability distribution I'm evaluating, right? Because toothache, the value of toothache doesn't change in this equation. Only the value of cavity does. So this is just going to be any old number. So the probability of this is basically proportional to the probability of this nominator. And so I can forget about computing the probability of toothache. I don't have to do it. All I have to do is make it, you know, assume it's some alpha, and then marginalize out the value of catch, which is the one that this joint probability is not interested in. So work out these numbers for cavity being true and cavity being false, okay? And you get this number. So So this is the probability, the joint probability of cavity being true and toothache. This is the joint probability of cavity being false and toothache. And then this alpha, well, you can just work it out through, you know, you've just got to make sure that your things ultimately add to one, but with the same ratio. So you just actually divide both these guys by the sum of these two guys. Right, so you never actually have to work out directly what the probability of toothache is. You can just normalize in this way. And sometimes computationally, that's a really, really good thing, because sometimes working this thing out directly can be a really computationally intensive task. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So here's the general inference pattern then. We let X be a query variable. Suppose I want to work out the probability distribution of cavity. I have some evidence that I can observe directly, like toothache, okay? And I've got other values, Y, that influence, that are part of the domain and influence the likelihood of other variables through their values, right? There are some dependencies going on here, some cause and effects. And Y is part of that, but I can't observe them. But I'm not interested in their values. This is the guy I'm interested in. But I have to think about how those influence the value of this, given that, basically. So the query evaluation then is, what is the most likely value of X given my observed evidence? Okay, well, that's going to be proportional, just as it was on the previous slide. It's this problem. Is proportional to the joint probability of X, given that evidence E, with this normalization thing here, representing basically the prior probability of that evidence that I'm ultimately not going to have to work out directly. But this isn't the full story, because there's these pesky Ys in there, these bunch of variables here, that I can't observe directly, but they affect the value of this joint probability distribution. So I have to marginalize out for those, right? Because this is the thing I know, is this joint probability. I don't know this directly. I know this triple directly, okay? So they're the complete set of variables. You can just look them up in the joint probability distribution, all right? So that's the general problem. But here's the problem with doing it with table lookup with a joint probability distribution. Apart from the fact that you very rarely have direct access to the joint probability distribution, in fact, you almost never do. Even if you did, these tables just get massive. Suppose you have n Boolean variables, then that table is it requires 2^n steps on those n variables to compute this thing. It's just massive. And there are very few examples of domains where all n variables are all interacting with all the n minus 1 variables they're not equal to directly. That's really, really rare. Okay? So when you're doing probabilistic inference, basically it really helps to know which variables are directly affecting which other variables and which ones are conditionally independent of one another, because that massively reduces the amount of information you need to know in order to answer any arbitrary query. Okay? So when you're doing probabilistic inference, and when people in machine learning or doing any inference involving likelihood are designing their domain, the first thing they think about is what is independent of what. And quite often they make really gross independence assumptions just to make the problem tractable. And even though the independence assumptions are gross and untrue, realistically they're untrue, quite often, nevertheless, they give relatively decent results and decent performance on the agent that you're building. Okay, so let's talk about independence then in more detail. In fact, a lot of what we're going to talk about over the next 2 weeks is about independence. Suppose we bring in another random variable into this dentistry domain, namely the weather, okay, which can take, I don't know, how many values can it take? I think it's 3, cloudy, rain, or sunny, or something. Anyway, it's a discrete variable, random variable, not a Boolean one, but a discrete one. And now what I want to do is compute the probability that I have a toothache catching cavity when the weather's cloudy. Okay? Now, for sure, I could, you know, if I had a joint probability distribution table with every cell filled, I could just read it off, that joint probability distribution table. But that's going to be, as I add variables to it, that table's going to get very big and is going to be become very implausible for me to fill each one of those cells. And I shouldn't need to anyway, because the probability that the weather is cloudy, given that I have toothache catch in the cavity, is really just the probability that the weather's cloudy, right? The state of my teeth does not affect what the clouds are doing, right? I don't affect nature that way, right? So that's really great, because then the joint probability is just the product of these individual probabilities. Okay, that's what probability theory would tell you. And so instead of having a table with 32 cells in them, eight times four, oh, there must be four values to weather, okay, 8 times 4, which is 32 cells, it's just a four-element table, okay? Which is great for working that out. So, more generally, the probability of X given Y is, if X and Y are independent of one another, is going to be just the probability of X. That's like saying Y has no influence on the value of X whatsoever. Even if you know Y, you're still just as clueless about what X is as you were before you observed Y. You don't know any more about the value of X, whatever you observe about Y's value. Equivalently, it will make Y independent of X. You can express this way, or you can express it this way. So there are three ways of expressing it. Okay? So, when a person is modeling an agent acting in a domain, they are exploiting their expert knowledge of the domain to decide which variables depend on one another and which are independent of one another, so that they can factorize this table into a sequence of much, much smaller tables, joint probability distributions, tables, okay? So they dramatically, by making independence assumptions, you dramatically reduce the complexity of the problem. And so you're just making them just to make the problem tractable quite often. Certainly in my field of natural language processing, you'd be aghast at the independence assumptions that really quite well-performing systems make. It's staggering. You can get away with murder in NLP. Actually, in some areas, you then plateau, and then it becomes, as performance plateaus, you have to work really, really hard for those last few percent to improve performance. Okay, towards the upper bound. So Bayes' rule is the thing that is ultimately going to drive probabilistic inference, and that combined with this notion of conditional independence. Okay, so the joint probability of A and B, you've probably seen this before, is equal to the probability of A given B times the probability of B. Okay, or equivalently, it's basically because conjunction's commutative, you can look at it as the probability of B given that A happened times the probability that A happened. Or this is another way of writing it. That's just maths, that's just algebra, right, given these two equations, okay? So the general case then uses multivariate variables using background evidence E, right? So if you're interested in your query Y, given your evidence E, and you've got some hidden variables X that you know factor into the equation, you can rewrite it this way. Why would you want to? Well, because sometimes estimating this directly is much, much harder than estimating these three guys. In fact, maybe you don't have to estimate this at all, depending on whether you're fixing the values of X, whether X is anything at all. But, you know, sometimes your access to estimating these is much, much easier than estimating this directly. That's why you kind of manipulate your query using Bayes' theorem. As you attempt to search for an equation that's defined in terms of a bunch of probability distributions that you basically have a cat and hell's chance of estimating. So here's an example involving meningitis and a stiff neck. Very apt for me today. I injured myself. I have a neck you wouldn't believe at the moment. I basically can't turn this way at the moment, but I don't have meningitis. Hurrah. Anyway, that's because I know I don't, because I don't have a fever. But anyway, we all know meningitis causes a stiff neck. In 50% of the cases of people who have meningitis, they've got a stiff neck, right? But there are also people with stiff necks that don't have meningitis, right? So there are many other causes to stiff necks. In my case, it was Lindy Hop. Long story. Okay, so suppose that I go to the doctor complaining of a stiff neck. I happen not to tell him about the Lindy Hop. And he really wants to assess this query. You know, he wants to assess, can I rule out meningitis or not? And of course, he wants to do that because any decision theoretic agent would really care about the value of meningitis given that it's life-threatening. Okay, then, but what he has access to is not this directly, but he knows the statistics of, you know, how often those with meningitis have stiff necks. He knows also the prior probability of meningitis, which actually, frankly, is rare. Then on the basis of that, he can compute, and the probability of a stiff neck, say, is 1 in 20, he can compute, in spite of my having one of the symptoms for meningitis, the chance that I have it is still pretty low, okay? It's 5,000, 1 in 5,000, okay? If I had a fever as well and was complaining of aching joints, you know, of course, this would shoot up because then we'd have more evidence for meningitis. But if this is all you know, then the chances of meningitis are still low, but a lot higher than they are. They've basically increased tenfold, right, compared with your prior estimate of my having meningitis if you know nothing about my physical state at the moment. Okay, so previously, right, we were able to avoid calculating this by using normalization, right? So suppose you don't have access to the probability of a stiff neck. Well, that's okay, so long as you have access to the probability of a stiff neck given no meningitis and the probability of no meningitis. Well, we have the probability of no meningitis if we've got this, given that it's a random Boolean variable. It's just going to be 1 minus this guy, i.e. pretty high. If we've got the probability of a stiff neck given no meningitis, then this will be easier to compute than this thing directly, yeah? And once we've got this whole probability distribution, we can just take the positive case and use our assessment that way, okay? So you kind of couch the problem in a way that you can answer it in probability theory, okay? You're just searching around for an equation where each one of these guys, you can kind of estimate what they are, what those probabilities are, all right? But the obvious question is why would a conditional probability be available in one direction and not the other? Why don't I have access to this, but I've got access to this? And one reason why is that quite often diagnostic knowledge of this kind, you know, I mean, this is a diagnosis, right? Do I have meningitis or not? Or, you know, an injury from Lindy Hop, you know, no meningitis. You know, this probability, the diagnostic knowledge, tends to be much more fragile because if you've got an epidemic of meningitis on your hands, then this guy goes up significantly, whereas the cause effect is still the same. The chances of a stiff neck, given you have meningitis, stays at 50%. You'll have more people with stiff necks because you've got more people with meningitis. But the proportion of people with stiff necks within the meningitis population will stay the same. So that stuff is much more stable. But going the other way with the diagnostic knowledge is really fragile to things like epidemics. And you may not know there's an epidemic on, right? I mean, if you're at the start of an epidemic, you may massively kind of miscalculate this guy, okay? So that's why we tend to go with this, if you know what the probability, prior probability of a stiff neck is, or this if you don't, okay? Yeah.
But if you're at the start of an epidemic, you're not going to know BLM correctly anyway.
No, you're not. No, you're not. No, but at least you, but yes, but you can revise your estimates. I mean, yes, so then, yes, that's a much more calculated, complex inference that is part of a later course, is basically on the basis of subsequent evidence, correcting your estimates on prior states is a whole other ball game. We get to that in a couple of weeks. But this is basically, you know, if you're working with a simplified problem, this is why you do it this way. It's just in general, you have knowledge of the proportion of meningitis population that has symptoms much more than you know the proportion of people with symptoms that have that diagnosis. Right? I mean, this is better studied. This kind of information is much better studied, and there's better figures on that than there is on the other way around. And one reason why is because, you know, this information is just too dynamic. So yes, this guy is a gross approximation for the same reasons. Okay. All right, so let's talk then about combining evidence. So suppose I've got toothache and a catch. What's the chances I have a cavity as well? Okay, well, we can now work that out in pretty much the same way, right? Using using in the joint probability distribution table, of course, we can work that out in the ways we have. I've already shown you. It turns out to be this. But it requires additional knowledge in the Bayesian model, right? So if you want to calculate this using Bayes' rule, right, using an equation that looks like that, rather than the joint probability, namely this, maybe because you don't have access to this, but what you do have is access to that, then it's going to look like this, right? Okay? So it's the probability of a toothache and catch given cavity times the probability of cavity, okay? So this, you know, in practice may be as hard as the joint probability distribution calculation. It may be. It depends on the extent to which this stuff is independent of one another. And basically, let's make a gross assumption. Well, it's actually not that gross in this case. That toothache and catch are independent of one another given the presence of cavity. In other words, although they both, although toothache can be a symptom for both, and so there's a direct relationship between catch and toothache on the one hand, and a direct one between cavity and toothache on the other, these aren't directly related, okay? They're only indirectly related via toothache. And nothing else, okay? It's in that sense that they are conditionally independent of one another. Once you know that, you can reduce this to this, okay? Can you see why? If you work it out in terms of these equations, it should become obvious. Okay. And these, of course, you need to know much less to compute each one of these, right? Then here, now, you don't need to know the joint probability of toothache and catch directly given a cavity. Just how many people with cavities get toothache, how many people with cavities get catches. That's all you have to know. But you don't have to know how many people get both given the cavity, okay? So here's the sort of maths in abstract form. We say that two variables, x and y, are conditionally independent given z, if this equation is true, okay? And if it is, then this is true as well. In other words, if x is conditionally independent of y given z, then Y gives you no evidence one way of the, or the other for X, assuming you know the values of Z are there in the condition as well. If you've observed Z, then that's enough. You don't need to know about the values of Y in order to estimate the values of X. That's what that's saying, okay? So if I know I've got toothache, that's enough for me to work out whether I've got a cavity or not, regardless of whether I've got a catch as well, okay? If I know the value of toothache, that's enough to estimate the value, the probability of the cavity given the toothache, okay? So, and equivalently, this as well is true, obviously, because the whole thing's symmetric. So it means that in our example, the probability distribution of cavity given toothache and catch is just this great big fat thing here. And as before, that massively reduces the the number of cells that we need to populate in this joint probability table. It's of the order of n instead of 2 to the n. Hurrah for that, right? Of the probabilities that we need to compute. And that's what makes probabilistic reasoning scalable at all. I mean, if you're dealing with a lot of variables, you better make some independence assumptions or you're just not going to be able to estimate anything in your domain, okay? So it's a black art, frankly, as a agent modeler to make the right independence assumptions that are going to give you effective performance. Okay, so that brings us then to the naive Bayes model, which is used all over the place. It's a grossly simple model, a really simple model of the behavior within a given domain where there's lots of causes and effects. But you'd be amazed how effectively this model performs on quite complex reasoning tasks. So we have a cause which has a number of effects. So meningitis, will affect temperature, affect the stiffness in the joints, the sensitivity to light, and all this business. The probability, but each of those individual effects are independent of one another, given the value of meningitis, right? Meningitis is affecting all of those things directly, but these temperature is not directly affecting stiffness in the joints or sensitivity of light, right? It's not the temperature that's causing those values, it's the meningitis that's causing them. That's the idea. Now, of course, actually, when you have a temperature, it does cause inflammation of the joints a bit. It's a little bit gross, okay? But nevertheless, when you make these idealized independence assumptions, you basically got to make the problem scalable. It makes it scalable because of the way the maths works out. Because when you're looking at this joint probability query, it factors into a product of much simpler things to estimate. Then all I've got to know is how many people with meningitis have stiff necks? How many people have high temperature? How many people are sensitive to light, and so on, okay? And those are easier things to go and find out. So a Bayesian classifier, called a Bayesian classifier, it's also called the idiot Bayes model because it is so ridiculously simple. But it really does work very well in a surprising number of domains. I mean, in my area of natural language processing, naive Bayes is used all over the place in part of speech tagging, in parsing, in language modeling, in automated speech recognition, in speech synthesis, everywhere. In dialogue act recognition, you name it, it's everywhere. Okay? So what we're going to be doing next time is looking at how you perform inference in a naive Bayes model, how you can do that in more detail, looking at a particular example involving burglary, earthquakes, alarms, and all the rest of it. That's in the Russell and Norvig textbook, okay? And eventually we will be expanding this into a temporal model as well. So to summarize what we've done today then, we looked at probabilistic inference, and it's an exact form of inference where you have the luxury of a full joint probability distribution, which for any domain of any complexity, you very rarely do. How wonderful life would be if you do, but you rarely do. And because of that, but thankfully, given probability theory, you can compute arbitrary queries from conditional probability distributions, which is useful and scalable so long as you make independence assumptions among the variables in the domain. Okay, so you're basically factoring the big fat problem, an arbitrary query, into a lot of little problems, which are little conditional probabilities that you're going to have to work out involving just a few variables. And by doing that, you can hopefully learn it from data, and that data won't be too sparse on the values of those few variables you're interested in. And that way, and then you take the product of them, and you can work out the estimate on the original query you were interested in. So Bayes' rule is coming to the rescue, basically, in making things. Bayes' rule plus gross independence assumptions are coming to the rescue in making random queries answerable. It's doable to calculate answers to those queries. So that's what we're going to do next time, is actually look at Bayesian networks that are naive Bayes models with conditional independence, with a way of representing conditional independence graphically, and how you reason with those. Okay, any questions? All right, see you tomorrow. No, see you Thursday.
What is that?